So today again, we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 24, Text 68.
Athatvamasino Brahman Paramatma Vipashitam Vishvam Rudra Bhayadvashtam Akutaschid Bhayagati.
Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki. My dear Lord, all actually learned persons know You as the Supreme Brahman and the Supersoul. Although the entire universe is afraid of Lord Rudra, who ultimately annihilates everything, for in the learned devotees, You are the fearless destination of all. Please repeat. My dear Lord,
All actually learned persons
know You as the Supreme Brahman and the Supersoul. Although the entire universe is afraid of Lord Rudra, who ultimately annihilates everything, for the learned devotees, You are the fearless destination of all. For the purpose of creation, maintenance, and annihilation of this cosmic manifestation, there are three lords, Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, Maheshvara. The material body is finished at the time of annihilation, but the universal body and the small unit, the living entity's body, are susceptible to annihilation at the ultimate end. However, the devotees do not fear the annihilation of the body, for they are confident that after the annihilation, they will go back home, back to Godhead. Tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mameti sorjana. If one strictly follows the process of devotional service, he has no fear of death, for he is predestined to go back home, back to Godhead. The non-devotees are fearful of death because they have no guarantee of where they are going or of the type of body they are going to get in their next life. The word Rudra Bhaya is significant in this verse, because Rudra himself, Lord Shiva, is speaking of fear of Rudra. Rudra himself, Lord Shiva, is speaking of fear of Rudra. This indicates that there are many Rudras, 11 Rudras, and the Rudra, Lord Shiva, who is offering this prayer to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is different from the other Rudras, although he is as powerful as they are. The conclusion is that one Rudra is afraid of another Rudra, because each and every one of them is engaged in the destruction of this cosmic manifestation. But for the devotee, everyone is afraid of Rudra, even Rudra himself. A devotee is never afraid of Rudra because he is always secure, being protected by the lotus feet of the Lord. As Sri Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 9:31, Kaunteya pratijanihi name bhakta pranashyati. My dear Arjuna, you may declare it publicly that my pure devotee will not be vanquished under any circumstances.
Om Gyanam Timiranthasya Gyanam Janashalakaya Chakshurun Melitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manopishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vancha Kalpatarubhyasya Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha.
Thank you for this opportunity. Again, I would like to request the blessings of the senior Vaishnavas who are present here so I can say something worthwhile. In this verse, we're continuing the chanting of the song sung by Lord Shiva. So this verse is said by Lord Shiva, who is Rudra himself. And he is Rudra. And he's speaking about the fear of Rudra. He's speaking about the fear of the destroyer, who is Lord Shiva. And he's saying that everyone in this material world, besides your pure devotees, is afraid of this Rudra, which is Lord Shiva. So Srila Prabhupada in the purport is saying that one Rudra is afraid of another Rudra. And this is the way of a mature life. That in mature life, everyone is afraid of that person who's stronger than him. and it continues up to the level of Rudras, up to the level of Lord Shiva. Even he is afraid of the other Rudras, of the Rudras who are above him. So, as you know, the famous Charles Darwin, right? Charles Darwin, before him, he wasn't the inventor of the evolutionary theory. Evolutionary theory existed before him. But his main contribution, what he did, which made it very famous, was this idea that he told people about the struggle for existence, right? The struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest. So he was actually right. I mean, this is the material world, right? On that point, he was correct. We disagree on other points, but on that point, he was correct. That it's the survival of the fittest. It's the struggle for existence. He's a very nice Christian boy. When he grew up, he was actually training to become a priest. And after some time, due to different events in his life, like his personal sickness, he became very sick, and the death of his young daughter, he became very disillusioned with religion and with God, because he couldn't understand why such a merciful and all-powerful Lord would inflict sufferings upon people and someone as innocent as his daughter. So after that, he thought that this isn't a perfect world, because in Christianity they have the idea that this is sort of heaven. This is heaven on earth. You know, it's meant to be God's world, and it's sort of meant to be a perfect world. And he said, and so he went searching for answers. You know, an alternate answer and alternate solutions. And he went on this voyage, this famous voyage. It was the Beagle voyage. And at that time, Britain was at its, peak, and they were conquering all different lands. So actually, this voyage, it went to South America to find the borders, to map out the borders of South America. This is the purpose of that voyage. So he also went on there. He jumped on the ship and went on this voyage with all the other people. Then when he got there, what he found was, in the middle of all these forests and all these jungles, this was South America at that time, when it was completely sort of devoid of civilization. There were some natives there, and they were the local natives, and they're just these tribal people with themselves and their dogs. And he went there and he saw that these people have no culture of God whatsoever. They have no goodness in themselves whatsoever. And they were quite cruel and savage. During the winter time, when they didn't have any food, then they would cut up their wives and eat them. And they had dogs also, but they wouldn't eat the dogs, because the dogs were at least useful. But in the winter time, the wives were not useful, so they cut and eat the wives. So when he saw this, then he realized that actually goodness is not at the heart of any living being. That actually, the Christian Bible said that God actually didn't create the world in his image. I mean, or people in this world weren't created in God's image. But rather he realized that this world was beastly and savage. So he said that that actually this world is not a perfectly designed world created by God, but it's a struggle for existence. It's the sheer struggle for existence. That's where his ideas first came from. And it's this struggle that drives the world. And it's this selfish gene, you could say, this gene of survival, of trying to survive oneself, that pushes the world. And those who are the fittest, they will survive, and they'll go on. So actually, before even he developed his evolutionary theory, these ideas were becoming very popular, of survive, struggle for existence. And we can see how, it was so dangerous, these ideas, because at that time, many of the big wars, they say, even scholars today say, Hitler's ideology and all these things, they were based on these ideas, these same ideas, that it was the survival of the fittest. That this world, actually historically they agree, that this is the result, you can see in some ways, of atheism. People say that atheism, like Richard Dawkins, he says that atheism is, theism, or the belief in God, is the root of all evil in the world. Right? That if religion was wiped out, then essentially evil in the world would be wiped out. But actually, the flip side is actually true, that when there was atheism, when these ideas of Darwin became very famous, then actually it led to the most brutal and horrible wars in history, in the history of mankind. Because this was Hitler's idea. It was the survival of the Aryan race, of the highest race. It was the survival of the fittest. It was, life is simply, it's just, you have to, whoever is the strongest will survive. And this is how they sort of justified their actions. At that time also, when they were conquering different lands, Britain was conquering different lands, so one of the places they conquered was Australia, right? Then even there, so many, we hear about World War II a lot, but there's so many other wars that happened, which are even worse. When they conquered Australia, then also they just found Aborigines there. So their policy, their state policy there when they went there was genocide. You just go and kill them off because the higher race has come. It was the survival of the fittest. So that's why to this day you find Darwin's picture on the 20-pound note of the English currency. He was part of the, you could say, of the philosophy, of the thought process. And so Darwin was correct in saying that this world is a struggle for existence and everyone is struggling for existence. But the part that he wasn't clear on and that he didn't tell was where that struggle stops. Okay, yes, the world is a struggle for existence. Everyone is struggling like anything. But where and when does that struggle stop? When does one actually become fearless? That everyone is afraid of the stronger one who will come and eat him or finish him. But when does that cycle of finish, of one man being the food for another person, where does that finish and where does the struggle for existence finish? That answer Darwin didn't know. And this here is being described by Lord Shiva. That it is the learned devotees who are the fearless destination. For the learned devotees, you are the fearless destination of all. That struggle for existence and that difficulty ends at the lotus feet of the Lord. You are the fearless destination of all. And therefore, on the one side, we find in mature life, everyone is fearful, right? This is one thing that, especially if one's a nature observer or nature watcher, you see that. That actually, nature is not so beautiful. It's very beautiful, actually, because Krishna's creation. But the living entities in nature are actually not so happy in that place. They're always in fear, right? The squirrel, when it eats even a little nut, it's always, it's constantly looking from left to right, from left to right. And in some ways, the lower the species, the more the fear is, right? Even fishes in the water, they're so fearful of the big fishes. And so everyone in this living entity is characterized in some ways by fear. And that fear leads to anxiety, right? That's why this place is Kunta. It's full of anxiety. But Krishna, his abode is Vaikunta, or free from all anxiety. So on the other hand, the devotee of the Lord, he has no fear. Why? Because he understands that everything in this world is controlled and owned by the Lord. And so whatever comes to him, whatever he comes across, is the plan of the Lord. In other words, the Lord only does anything to us, only does that which is best for us. So he knows that that he's under the shelter of the Lord. Whatever the Lord puts in front of him is the best for him. And at the end, he's not afraid of death, right? Ultimately, where is the fear brought from? Why is everyone fearful? What is the cause of fear? Is death, right? No one wants to die, and we're forced to die. So that's the fear of death. But the devotee is not afraid of death, right? He's not fearful of death. That's the main point. That's the significant thing here. Because Prabhupada here in the purport is saying, however, the devotee has no fear, does not fear the annihilation of the body, for they are confident that after the annihilation, they will go back home, back to Godhead. Right? So therefore, the devotee has no fear. Because even if he dies, that destination is better than where he's at. Right? So what is there to fear? He's in a sort of a miserable place, and in fact, death is in some ways a great liberation for the devotee. It's a great freedom. He feels very happy being free from death at that point. So one may say that for devotees who are practicing, now of course for the pure devotees, they may have already realized the Lord, right? But for devotees who are practicing, there is still fear, right? Because we have the fear that maybe at the end of life, at the time of death, we may not remember Krishna. Right? We may not remember him, and so therefore we may not go back to him. And so we may feel still fearful that, there is a cause. The devotee may still feel fearful that I may not have a very nice destination because I may not go back to Krishna. I may even go to the hellish planets or for some things that I've done, or I may end up in the heavenly planets and stay there and then come back down here. So it seems like, though Srila Prabhupada here is saying that the devotee becomes fearless, that if a devotee is humble, he'll sort of always have this fear, right? Because he'll think that at the time of death, I may not remember Krishna. So that's in some ways true, that maybe that due to humility, that slight fear is there. But I was just reading something very interesting recently, that how we were discussing this actually in our class, in our Vaishnava Acharya's class, that how one of the six principles in the Sri Sampradaya, in the Ramanuja Sampradaya, that Ramanuja Acharya taught, he had six main truths or six main principles. And one of them was Antim Smriti Varjanam, which literally means, it means thought of me, meaning the Lord, thought of the Lord at the last moment is not compulsory. In other words, thought of the Lord at the last moment, at the time of death, is not compulsory. So Krishna, in the Gita, he writes, right, in the Bhagavad Gita, it's a central text for Ramanujacharya and his followers, he writes how one must remember me at the time of death. Jai Shishirada Gopinath ki jai. He says how in order to those who remember me at the time of death, they attain me. Those who remember other other beings, they go to their planets. So you go to where you remember. So this verse is there, but they in some ways, Ramanujacharya clarifies this, that though Krishna is saying that, he's saying that that it's not compulsory, actually. The devotee doesn't have to remember the Lord at the moment of death. So, how is this possible? Why is he saying this? Because he says that they have the principle of prapatti. He says that if for the devotee who surrenders his life to Krishna, right, and throughout his life he surrendered to the Lord, that devotee can be confident that even if he doesn't remember the Lord at the time of death, the Lord will take him back to God. He'll take him back to his own abode. So either that will happen, or the Lord will manifest himself within the mind of the devotee. So if the devotee doesn't remember the Lord will come in the mind of the devotee. And I was thinking that actually Srila Prabhupada says the same thing, right? One time devotees asked Srila Prabhupada, and they said that we have to go out on Sankirtan, and we have so many, we meet so many people, and our mind, we're not in the temple most of the time, or reading and chanting. So our mind is thinking of so many things. So we're a bit afraid that due to this service, we may not remember the Lord at the time of death. You know, our mind may not be purified, and we may not remember the Lord at that moment of death. So Srila Prabhupada, he says that I think this is specifically in relation to book distribution. So he said that if you go on distributing my books until the end of your life, then Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu will forcefully enter into your mind and take you back home, back to God. Like that. So this is the mercy of the Lord, that this is the path, you could say, in some ways, the path of surrender. When the devotee surrenders himself unto the Lord, when he surrenders his mind, body, and words, then he actually doesn't have any fear. He's not afraid of death or even of forgetting of the Lord, because he's confident of the Lord's protection. He's confident that the Lord will protect him at the last moment. Therefore, death is not fearful to him. There's a nice verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, a very famous verse, that Lord Brahma says to Lord Krishna when at the end, not at the end, but at the when Krishna is a small child, and after Brahma stole his cows and coward boys, and when Krishna comes back and Lord Brahma offers prayers, then he offers this wonderful prayer to the Lord.
Tattenukampam susamikshamano punjanayevatmakritam vipakam hridvagvapurbhir vidadham namaste jivetayo mukti padesadaya bhak.
My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances within his heart, words and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. So he's saying that he who continues with his devotional service very earnestly, and he waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances within his heart, words and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. Such a devotee who undergoes all tribulations and passes all the tests of the Lord, for that it becomes his rightful claim, right? His rightful claim. So we find this in the life story of Dhruva Maharaj, right? That Dhruva Maharaj was such an advanced devotee, such a wonderful devotee. And during his lifetime, he was performing so many activities of a king, you know, different. He was ruling the planet, he was fighting demons, and he was doing all these different things. But at the end, at his last moment, when death came to him, when death personified approached him, then the aeroplanes from the Vaikuntha planet, they also came. And death also came. But death kneeled down and he served as a footstool for Dhruva Maharaj. So Dhruva Maharaj could put his feet on his head and board the aeroplane of Lord Vishnu and go back home, back to Godhead. So for such a devotee, it becomes his rightful claim. You know, there's no fear. He's not afraid of death because the protection of the Lord is there. He feels that protection of the Lord. So therefore, we've described how the devotee, therefore, is not afraid of anything in this world. Right? There's nothing that the devotee is afraid. He's completely fearless under the shelter of the Lord. But Srila Prabhupada described, and yesterday we were also discussing, the devotee is afraid of something. Right? He's afraid of two things. What might those two things be? Someone might suggest. Forgetting about Krishna. Okay. Yes. Yes. Offenses to the Vaishnavas. Wow. Yes. It's just both were exactly on the dot sort of answers. The way Prahlad Maharaj says, the way he writes, is he says that I'm not afraid of anything. Actually, I brought this verse. I'll read you these verses. So the first one is, as you have said, forgetting the Lord, right? Forgetful of the Lord. So Prahlad Maharaj, he's just a small boy, right? And Lord Nrisimhadev comes before him and he kills his father, this demon, Hiranyakashipu. And he's trembling. Lord Nrisimhadev is trembling. And the whole world is trembling as a result of seeing Lord Nrisimhadev, right? All the demigods, Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, everyone is just trembling. Because the Lord's form is so fearful. It's so, it's just frightening. And so then no one can approach Lord Nrisimhadev. And so Lord Brahma, he asks Prahlad Maharaj to go forward. And he approaches him, no problem. Right? He goes and he falls at the feet of Lord Nrisimhadev. And then he offers these beautiful prayers to Lord Nrisimhadev. And he says, I am certainly not afraid of your ferocious mouth and tongue, your eyes bright like the sun, or your frowning eyebrows. I do not fear your sharp pinching teeth, your garland of intestines, your mane soaked with blood, or your high wedge-like ears. Nor do I fear your tumultuous roaring, which makes elephants flee to distant places, or your nails, which are meant to kill your enemies. Right? So all these things, I mean, imagine someone with a garland of intestines. But Srila Prabhupada explains that just like the lion is not an object of fear for the lion cub, similarly, Lord Nrsimhadev, the Lord in that form, is not an object of fear for his devotees. Rather, he's an object of great comfort. Right? We've got such a powerful master who scares everyone else in this world. Right? And so he's saying that all these things they don't scare me. But then he says one thing. He says, "O most insurmountable Lord, who are kind to the fallen souls, I have been put into the association of demons as a result of my past activities, and therefore I am very much afraid of my condition of life within this mature world. When will that moment come when you will call me to the shelter of your lotus feet, which are the ultimate goal for liberation from conditional life?" So he's seeing the Lord face to face. The Lord is present in front of him, right? And he's offering prayers to the Lord. But still he's saying that I'm afraid of the condition of life, of this material condition of life. Right? That this material world is still a great object of fear for me. That I'm afraid of falling back into Maya and forgetting your lotus feet. Forgetting your lotus feet. So this type of fear is healthy. It's good, right? A little fear is good. Right? Just like children should not be fearful of their parents, right? It should be out of love, they should have this. But they should be a little bit afraid of their parents, right? Little fear is good. Even to this day, I'm a little afraid of my father, right? A little afraid. Why? Because that's a form of respect. In some ways, it's respecting that person. Or we may be a little afraid of our authorities or our spiritual master or something like this. Because that's reminding us that we're small, we're little, right? We're under the control of someone else. So one way of respecting Lord Krishna's energy, of his Maya potency, is to be afraid of it, right? Because we realize that this is actually Krishna's power, Krishna's energy. So there's nothing that I can do to win over Krishna's energy, right? And as soon as we think, we have this idea that now nothing can bother me. You know, I'm beyond everything. That I've transcended everything. Then at that very moment, Krishna humbles us, right? We fall down, right? Just like in the pastime of Lord Shiva, right? Where Shiva and Mohini Murthy, that as soon as the devotee, no matter how advanced he is, if he feels overconfident about the material world and about the potency of Maya, then immediately Krishna humbles that devotee. So here Prahlad Maharaj is saying that my only fear is that I may not forget your lotus feet. That's my only desire. So that is something that the devotee is fearful of. He doesn't want to fall back in this material world. So that's one thing. Then we'll just do the other thing and finish with that. The other point, something that the devotee is even more fearful of, is offending the devotees of the Lord. And for that matter, offending any living entity of the Lord. Because I learned in my Bhakti Shastri class, when I took Bhakti Shastri, one of our teachers, my teacher was Vrindavan Das Thakur Das Prabhu. He's a very, very nice teacher. And he said that there's only two things that can sort of permanently take us away from Krishna consciousness. Right? Permanently meaning for a long time. For a long time they can take us away from Krishna consciousness. And he said, one is the desire of the Lord. Right? If the Lord desires, then we can lose our Krishna consciousness. But really, Krishna has no reason to desire that, right? Why will he desire that? He's calling us back to him. You know, he's calling us back to his lotus feet. So he's always wanting us to come back. And he said the other thing is offending the Vaishnavas or offending the devotees of the Lord. Is there anything else, you know, if we become attracted to the material energy, then we'll leave for some time and then we'll come back. You know, we'll come back very soon back to Krishna's lotus feet. Or if we become philosophically mixed up, you know, we try to imitate the gopis or something like this, then that'll last for some time and will come back. You know, Krishna's, even the sahajas are dear to Krishna because they're approaching in some way. But if we offend the great souls, the devotees of the Lord, then it takes a very long time. It's very difficult to come back. Very, very difficult to come back. So, of all the things, that's one thing, therefore, that the devotee wants to be most conscientious of, or you could say most careful of, because that's the one thing that is the most dangerous, right? It can take us away from Krishna's service for a very, very long time. So that's why it's better to be safe than sorry, right? To be on the safer side, to not offend the devotees of the Lord. Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada, in the Nectar of Instruction, he describes the qualities of the Uttamadhikari devotees of the Lord. And he describes two qualities. And the first one, he says, the first one is that the pure devotee of the Lord, the Uttamadhikari, is completely free from the propensity to blaspheme others. Right? To blaspheme others. And the second quality, he said, is that he's always absorbed in trying to find means or methods on how to spread Krishna consciousness. So in these two ways, he describes that are the qualities of a great devotee. So as soon as we criticize another devotee, then immediately we're not a pure devotee ourselves. Right? When we criticize someone for not being a pure devotee, then we're not a pure devotee ourselves. Because the quality of the pure devotee is that he's free from the propensity of blaspheming others. And therefore, this is something that is completely given up by the devotee, is this blasphemy of, because he's very fearful of this. He's very much afraid of this. Just like we have the wonderful story of Magrari, right? That when he became a devotee, we had this song, right? Magrari was a wicked, wicked one. He half killed animals just for fun. He let their little bodies die within the forest to slowly die. But by chanting he became pure. But by chanting he became pure. But by chanting he became pure and developed love for Krishna. So once he became pure, and he was after chanting the names of the Lord, then after that, he was so gentle, he was so compassionate, from becoming a hunter who half killed animals and let their bodies lie within the forest to slowly die. From that point, he became so gentle that when he used to walk, then he used to be careful not to step on any of the ants that were treading the road. Right. When Narad Muni came, and he came to visit his disciple again after initiating him and after teaching him about devotional service, when he came, then he saw that this disciple of mine is coming so slowly, and he's wobbling as he walks, and he is thinking that why is it? Why is he doing this? Right? Who is with him? I forget. Parashramuni. So Parashramuni asked Narad Muni that why is he walking like this? Why doesn't he just come forward and offer respects to you? And then Narad Muni said that the reason why he's not is because he doesn't want to step on the ants that cross his path. Right? And so it's not just the devotees of the Lord that the devotee respects, but every living entity. Right? He doesn't want to bring pain to any other living entity. And that's a very significant point, that even the ants, what to speak of other human beings, even the ants, the devotee is so careful. When for a short time I was traveling with Gopal Krishna Maharaj, and he used to go on his japa walk, right? And then on the side, this is just like on the green belt, on any city in America, and generally the green belt is next to a river, right? So on the side, there would be always someone fishing, you know, some people fishing. Right? So he'd be walking and chanting, and then the people would be fishing. And in between, like when we'd come across someone who was fishing, he would tell one of us, he'd say, "Go tell that person it's not good to fish." And we would be standing there trying to figure out, well, what do we do now? This person is fishing. How do we go and tell this person it's not good to fish? So somehow we would have to gain the courage, right? And go and tell that person, "So actually, it's not very good to fish," and then run away, you know, walk away like that. So this is another, you know, this is a quality of a devotee, that he cannot tolerate the suffering of another living entity. So yare dekhe tarake ho Krishna upadesh. Wherever he is, whoever he meets, he tells them about Krishna. He tells them not to fish. So he was actually much better at it. He just walk near them and shout out to them and say, "It's not good to fish. Today you're fishing and tomorrow you will be fished." So we have to inform people of this, because then, you know, they can go to, at the end of their life, they'll go to Yamraj and they'll say, "Well, I was never even told about this. You know, no one even informed me. The devotees came and they saw me fishing. They didn't even say anything." Right? So we can tell them in a gentle way. Nice. So thank you very much. So this is, in conclusion, this is the devotee has no fear, but he's afraid of these two things. We should always try to be conscientious of this, not to be overconfident of the material world, to be always fearful of the material energy, and to be fearful of offending any other living entity. Thank you. Hare Krishna. If there's any comments,
sir. Okay.
So when I stress so strongly that one of the two things that you can ask for Krishna is offending the devotee or the entity, so then you should know what constitutes an offense. What offense is so powerful that it would actually keep us from Krishna? Just the blasphemy of the devotee, or stepping on ants. I was careful not to step on ants, but we're stepping on ants every day. Yeah.
I guess so. The question is how serious is an offense? Basically, what constitutes a serious offense to the devotee of the Lord? I don't know, maybe would you like to?
The best thing is to think that any offense is serious. I mean, if you start splitting hairs trying to figure out, well, that's not quite serious enough. I can slap you in the face.
Right.
A punch is serious.
Right.
But, I mean, I was telling the students in my Bhaktisastra class, for Krishna, sin is nothing. You think of Jagannatha, you committed everything. So, but somehow Krishna, what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu gave them, they became purged of all their sin. By a few things, by you know, trying to help the Chaitanya people, by promising never to sin again, by going to go to Chaitanya speak, they received the message of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So we could say that at some point all we have to do is beg for the mercy of Krishna, and, you know, whatever sin we do, he'll forgive us. But Prabhupada always said, don't depend on our ability to grieve.
Yes.
Don't depend on so, I mean, if there's a question, is that sinful or not? Is that offensive or not? Err on the side of caution.
Yes. That's a very nice point, actually. It's better to err on the side of not making the offense. Yes. Also, I was thinking one thought that came to me just following what you were saying is how I forget one devotee in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he offended one of the associates of Lord Chaitanya, and so he came to Lord Chaitanya to ask for a solution, for an atonement, what he can do as a result of the offense. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said that with the same mouth we drink poison, and with the same mouth we can drink nectar. So he said, by offending the devotee, you have just drunk poison. So now what you should do, you should make it your activity that you go and you praise all the devotees of the Lord. That whichever devotees you find, you praise them. So in this way you'll drink nectar, and that will help cure that. So we could take it positively, in the sense that rather than one thing to see what not to do, but on the flip side, what to do, what we can do to avoid them. Well, as whatever is practical, right? As far as possible, for our service. Because one thing Prabhupada, he said, everyone's servant is no one's servant, right? So that principle also there, that the devotee, he's not a servant of the masses, right? He's not trying to serve every living entity. He's a servant of Krishna and his devotees. That point is also clear to him. So, and he knows that he understands by pleasing them and doing it properly, he is serving all the other living entities as well. So he also has that in mind, that okay, I have a service to fulfill for my spiritual master, so I need to walk from here to there, and that may result in yes.
This is not the what if scenario. You know,
what if?
Yes.
Yes.
Because what if questions can go on perpetually?
Mm.
But the real issue is what is your consciousness?
Mm.
You know, you said 15 minutes, what were you thinking of when you were walking? Were you serving Krishna or those 15 minutes? Or were you trying to avoid 10 and you're still on 15 minutes?
Mm.
Because really, Krishna only accepts our intention. Our heart, our consciousness is the offering that we make to Krishna.
Mm.
So, depending on where our heart is, Krishna reciprocates with that. That's what we need to work on. Okay. And then everything else comes, you know, behind that. So, you can what if yourself. The point is, if you're trying to please Krishna, and that's your sincere desire, then 99.9%
of the time to do the
right thing, and if you don't, then you'll find out how to deal with it.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yes, wow, nice point. Yes.
I don't know that kind of answers to just
non-bodies.
Before we came to Krishna
consciousness,
we
just want to
Mother
Vishakha, would you like to answer this question? Yes, I've also heard or thought that if, like you're saying, if they're no longer around, we can maybe pray for them as well. Is that, you know, offer pray for them that Krishna might help them, or in some ways. Can you speak louder? It's clear.
As the people are dying, they come for God. Process, and you see me when I was hungry, when I was tired, when I was in trouble, and you did not help me. He said, Lord, when did we see you tired and hungry and did not help me? He said, I tell you, whatever you did unto the least of these, you did unto me.
Yes, nice point. Yes, the Lord is present within everyone's heart. So when we offend a living entity, then we're offending the Lord. Yes, because the living entity is part and parcel of the Lord, and also he's present within the heart of every living entity. So that's very true. Another example I was thinking of was Mother Kunti. She was one devotee in our movement. And she is... Yeah. Not the Kunti from the Bhagavatam. This is the Kunti from New Vrindavan. Yes, sorry. And she was a very advanced devotee. She was serving New Vrindavan for many, many years. And after that, at the end of her life, she got cancer. She got a type of cancer like this. And it was amazing how, just as an example of also fearlessness, transcended that cancer in some ways, responded to it. Her doctors would give her painkillers, right, morphines. These are very strong painkillers. And she wouldn't take them because she wouldn't need them. And she had bone cancer, which is the most painful form of cancer. But she wouldn't take them. And actually, her family members, they weren't devotees, you know, like that. And some of her family members would steal the morphine, and they would take it, but she wouldn't be taking them. She had transcended it, and they were they're going through so much difficulty in just seeing this and you know losing their family member that they were feeling you could say greater pain, greater suffering. But anyway, the point was that at the end of her life, she. As a young devotee, she had sort of left her family, and sometimes she hadn't dealt with them properly, and she always sort of felt unhappy about that. She felt that, you know, I offended them, and she felt very morose about that, and that she wasn't able to do anything for them also. So it's amazing that at the end of her life, Krishna gave her that opportunity. And because she had cancer, because she had served the Lord sincerely, and like you were saying, her heart had changed, you know, her consciousness had changed, and she had this strong desire, Krishna brought her whole family together at the end of her life. And she was able to reciprocate with them, and you could say, offer them gifts that were invaluable, you know, sort of make a relationship with them again, and you know, and transform their lives. So that they're, after this whole incident, her whole family sort of became very Krishna conscious, very very elevated, like that. So that's also a point that Krishna, to the sincere devotee, at the end of their, during their life or by the end of their life, he'll give a chance or give an opportunity for that devotee to make up with that person, and actually give them something even more wonderful, give them Krishna consciousness. Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.